Blog Talk Radio.
Someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted. Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies. And that's no fairy tale.
Yes, and you can get these wonderful, delicious brownies at www.brownies.com. They also make cookies. Yes, they have two types of cookies. One is a double chocolate, and the other is caramel pecan or something. I don't really care because it's not chocolate, and I'm a chocoholic. So, but anyway, so I can't imagine that. I don't know. You may not want to have that though with Dr. Pepper. I don't think that works. I'd rather have a glass of milk. What do you think?
I don't know. It sounds delicious. I want brownies now.
The brownies are just something else. Oh God, really? It's like the epitome of a brownie. Anyway, so introduce yourself to my audience.
Good morning. My name is Jenny Shepherd, and I am Director of Visitor Services and Communications at the Dr. Pepper Museum in Waco.
Cool. Now, I'm a pepper. You're a pepper. Everybody is a pepper, too. You think
Wouldn't
so?
You like to be one? Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to tell us, like, all right, Maple Leaf, like you were giving me the tour.
Okay.
So let's start where would we begin by telling the story of how this all started.
I will do it. The Dr. Pepper Museum is located in downtown Waco in the historic Artesian Manufacturing and Bottling Company building. It was built in 1906. It was the first building built specifically to bottle Dr. Pepper. Dr. Pepper was invented here in Waco in 1885. It was invented by a pharmacist, a man named Dr. Charles Alderton. And most of the time, he spent his time back in the pharmacy mixing up medicine for the people of Waco. But he loved the way that the soda fountain smelled, made the Old Corner Drugstore smell. So he decided he was going to create a recipe that would taste like that smell. So he tried many different concoctions, and he gave them to the owner of the store, Dr. Morrison. And he finally hit upon one that he thought was pretty good. The people of Waco taste tested it, and they thought it was pretty good, so he started marketing it. It was originally called a Waco, but it was patented on December the 1st, 1885, as Dr. Pepper. They served Dr. Pepper in the soda fountain for several years. Other soda fountains around Waco started asking for the syrup so that they could serve it as well. And then in 1891, they started bottling it. They bottled it here in Waco in some buildings that had already been built that were already existing. And then, like I said, in 1906, they built the building that we're in now for the specific purpose of bottling soft drinks. They bottled here until the 1960s when the demand for Dr. Pepper, people switched over to cans. They were had begun switching over to cans, and the building was not big enough to house a canning factory. So they actually closed down this plant in the mid-1960s, and it stood vacant until the mid-1980s when a group of Wacoans decided that it was a building worth preserving. So it was the restoration started at the end of the 1980s. They opened the doors May the 11th, 1991, excuse me, and we've been operating ever since. We've had over 1.2 million visitors.
Wow. Now, I think when I first walked in, there was this big, photo. I understand this because...
Right, it was a photo of downtown Waco. Mm-hmm.
Right. Before the...
Go ahead.
And also before there was a storm. What was there?
Right. In 1953, there was a huge tornado that came through downtown Waco. And it killed 114 people, and it just pretty much devastated the downtown area. The Dr. Pepper Museum building was hit, but they were able to patch it back up, and they were able to get back to the bottling within about 6 weeks. When the museum was restored, they restored the original arches and architecture that had been there before. When it was patched up, they just sort of did a patch job so they could get back to work. But when it was restored, it was restored to how it originally looked. But the tornado was devastating. It was devastating. It actually destroyed the Old Corner Drugstore on the corner of 4th and Austin, where Dr. Pepper was invented.
Wow. So now I think from there, that's when we went into the room where the
Artesian Well.
Did we go there first, the Artesian Well, before the...
No, you would go into a recreation of the Old Corner Drugstore.
Yeah.
And in the Old Corner Drugstore, we have an audio animatron, which is a moving, talking mannequin, and who looks like Dr. Alderton. And he would give you a little Waco history lesson, and he would show you kind of how the soda fountain was set up. And then he would talk about his invention. Dr. Pepper was first served nationwide in 1904 at the World's Fair, and it really caught on. It was very popular. And so it, along with the ice cream cone and I believe the hamburger, were introduced in 1904 at the St. Louis World's Fair. So then you would come back into the back area of the first floor, and you would see some wonderful old bottling equipment. We have an old bottle washer that is in the middle that's really kind of amazing. It's the old-timey. You would load the bottles in, and they would rotate around. They would use a very strong acid to clean all the gunk and gradu out of the returned bottles. And the acid was so strong that if it dripped on the floor, it would eat through the concrete. You can actually see on the floor where the concrete is pitted, where the acid had dropped on the floor. And then back in the back corner is the interior artesian well. Waco sits above an artesian well, and when the building was created and built in 1906, they dug a well to use the natural spring waters that were underneath the ground. In the 1920s, Waco passed a city ordinance saying that you had to cap and fill in all interior artesian wells, and that the water that you used to be able to get for free, you now had to purchase from the city. So they did actually fill in the well. They capped the well, and they sort of used it as a trash dump. They swept in old broken bottles, broken machinery parts, etc., and they just filled it up, and then they covered it over. So when the museum opened in 1991, that area was covered up. And so they brought in a man with a jackhammer who had a memory of how the building used to be set up. They looked at blueprints, and he dug a little while, and pretty quickly he found the well. They excavated it down to 27.5 feet using rappelling equipment and some wonderful volunteers from the Baylor University, which is just down the block. And that's when they hit water, so they had to stop. But if you do come in the museum, you can look down into the well and see where they used to get the water for the soft drinks here.
Oh, how do you like that? Or should I say, well, well, well.
To the right of the artesian well, or the left, depending on how you're standing, we have a series of different bottling equipment. We have an 1890s filler and capper that was totally hand-operated. You would take an empty bottle, step on a pedal, and a spigot would go down into the bottle, turn a lever and add the syrup, step up again, move the bottle to another lever, step down again, and it would add the carbonated water. Then you'd move it over to the side, add a cap, and it would cap the bottle. You had one step left. You needed to mix the syrup and the water. So you would see bottlers grabbing them by the neck, sort of swinging them up and down again, and that would mix the syrup and the drink together. A good bottler on that bottling machine could bottle about 6 bottles a minute. So it took about 10 seconds for a quick worker to bottle one of those. Of course, today you can bottle almost 3,000 bottles a minute on the automated lines that we have today.
And I understand there's a second place that does the Dr. Pepper, which is in Dublin, and that's where the... Because there's two sort of formulas?
They do. Dublin Dr. Pepper bottles Dr. Pepper with the pure cane sugar. There are actually several bottling plants that do use the pure cane sugar recipe, but they use the return bottles. And they bottle several times a month. I have not ever been to see the bottling line in progress, but I've heard it's pretty neat. But do call before you go, because it is not a regular, they don't bottle on a regular schedule.
Do you have a preference of the sugar cane or the corn syrup?
You know, I drink Diet Dr. Pepper.
Oh, okay.
So it would be neither of those. But I, of course, grew up with the corn syrup Dr. Pepper is what I'm more familiar with. But we do sell the sugar Dr. Pepper, and it's really good. It's not quite as heavy. And it doesn't have quite the aftertaste that the corn syrup does. It's just a different kind of taste.
Yeah, I had that when I was at Uncle Dan's barbecue.
Yep, they have it on tap, as they say.
Yeah, and I liked it better with the sugar cane.
A lot of people that remember it before the late 70s, early 80s say that was, oh yes, that's the taste. And they say you should get it in a bottle and chill it and not add water to it so you can get the pure taste.
And okay, so then there was, then there was an area that kind of showed some paraphernalia.
Oh yes, we have lots of different we have a small area between the old corner drugstore and the back area where the bottling equipment is that holds temporary exhibits. And so right now out there we're in the process of taking down the Dr. Pepper Christmas promotions that they had over the years. But that is an ever-changing exhibit. It lasts usually about 6 months, the temporary exhibit. And then did you travel up to the second floor?
Uh, I don't remember. What was on the second floor?
The second floor is where they mixed the syrups here in the museum. And a portion of it still has the original flooring that they had when they bottled here. It's a wooden floor, and it has lumps in it. It's elevated in two places. And at the end of the day, every day, they would come in with a hose, and they would hose down the wooden floor because it was sticky from all the syrup. And mm-hmm. the floor was built so that the rises in the floor made the water run to the edge of the room. And all the way around the edge of the second floor, there was an interior gutter system that would take all that dirty, sticky water, and it would go straight into the sewer system. Of course, it breaks my heart that they hose down a wooden floor every single day, but they did. And,
yeah.
They insulated the floor by putting down the floorboards, and then they put down a layer of tar paper, like you would get on for your roof, and then they put down the wooden planks on top of that, so it was sealed so that the water would not go down to the first floor. But it's kind of fascinating to see people walk on it and say, wait, that's kind of lumpy. I said, it is. It is. And it was built that way by design.
Well, I think there was I remember that there was a whole thing regarding advertising.
Oh, yes. We have lots of exhibits about advertising. The Dr. Pepper Museum is actually not owned by Dr. Pepper. We're a not-for-profit institute. So when you come here, you will see other soft drinks as well. And so we have different kinds of Coca-Cola advertising, Pepsi, Orange, Crush, Sprite, 7-Up, et cetera. And we use those in different exhibits. Right now we have an exhibit that's up called About Inventors. It talks about the invention, the people that invented Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and Dr. Pepper as well, just to name a few.
And then also there was some commercials you could...
Absolutely. We have a wonderful trove of old Dr. Pepper commercials beginning in... We have radio commercials that go back to the beginning of the 20th century, and we have... regular commercials that go back to the late 60s. So you can choose a decade that you'd like to watch, and you can push the button, and you can see wonderful old Dr. Pepper commercials. Of course, one that many people remember is the I'm a Pepper campaign that came out in the late 1970s with David Naughton starring as the singer and dancer as he dances his way across America, bringing Dr. Pepper for all those that love it, to all those that love it, and inviting everyone to be a pepper with him.
Yeah. Next place I want to get to is, before we get to the gift shop, the soda fountain.
We have a working old-fashioned soda fountain. And then when you come into the Dr. Pepper Museum and you head into the soda fountain, you can ask them to shoot you a Waco, and the soda jerk will add syrup to the bottom of the cup and then go over to the soda fountain and add the carbonated water, just like they used to do 100 years ago. It's wonderful to watch. It's just fascinating. So many young kids, of course, have never seen it made before them. To them, it's either comes from a spigot at a fast food restaurant or in a bottle or a can. So they'll say, wait, what are you doing? So, oh, we add the syrup first, and then they shoot the carbonated water in, and it's much fun to watch. We also have things like Simple Sundaes, which is Bluebell ice cream with Dr. Pepper syrup on top. That's a favorite here, as well as floats and things like that.
You know, it's funny that you said 100 years ago, that when I was actually, it was very typical, in New York City at least, that people would, you'd have the seltzer man.
Uh-huh.
And so you would buy syrups from the seltzer man, and you get the bottle of the seltzer, and people made their own drinks that way.
Yep, you can make your own.
That was a hoot.
And you can, when you do things like that, we have a tour, a children's tour that's called Create Your Own Soft Drink, and they use different fruit syrups, and they can, you know, try different combinations, what tastes good, root beer, lemon, coconut, strawberry, vanilla, cherry, raspberry, all those, see what tastes good together, and then they create their own soft drink, and they mix together the syrups, and then they add the seltzer water, the carbonated water, and it's a wonderful, wonderful program that thousands of children have participated in and really enjoyed.
And me too.
And you too. Did you get to create one?
Yes, that's I did that. And I mixed, let's see, it was, I wound up with the, I did cherry, mostly cherry, and then lime and lemon.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Oh,
sounds
yeah,
wonderful.
It came out great, and I called it a, tropical chicken because, you didn't meet my two rubber chickens.
No, but I heard about them.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that was Esther saying hello.
Good morning, Esther. Well, you can get some delicious flavors, and then you get some that kind of tastes like shoe polish. But
yeah, it's true. You have to kind of figure out what might taste well. Well,
right.
I did that one because there was a drink I used to a soda fountain drink. They call it Cherry Lime Ricky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know where the Ricky came from. But I guess it was like cherry syrup, salsa, and some lime juice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, let me see how this, you know, comes out with that.
And was it close to what you remembered?
Oh, yeah. Well, but I will added a little lemon to give it a little more kind of zest to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, I came out with some quite interesting ones. None that tasted bad, because I also did cherry, and then I did a little bit of red raspberry and lime.
Mhm. Mhm.
On that one, and that was none of them. I hit three good ones.
Oh, good, good.
and you could see on my blog. You could see the picture of Esther and Eunice showing off the
their drink.
Their drink, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, we learned early on not to mix lemon and root beer. It's hard to get down. they're
yeah,
not complimentary flavors.
Yeah, you got to try it. I was trying to make a blue drink,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
Because the only blue you have is coconut, but as soon as you mix it, there's nothing else that you can mix it with to keep the blue color.
Right, right. Yep. Yep. You have
and the
to,
reason I was trying to make a blue drink is because the New York Sharks, I'm the director of public relations for the New York Sharks women's tackle football team.
Uh-huh.
And our color is blue, so I was going to name one the shark drink into something. I went, can't do that. Nothing's going to come out blue.
Yep.
And you don't want just pure coconut.
Right, and when you add coconut to things, it's a very powerful flavor, and sometimes that's just about all you can taste.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that what you invented sounds delicious.
Yeah, try it sometime. But I understand it, except for the syrup. But there are other things that. I know. When I was at the When I was at Uncle Dan's barbecue,
mm-hmm.
he had a bottle. He hadn't used it yet. He had a bottle of a barbecue sauce with Dr. Pepper syrup in it.
Yes. They have a barbecue sauce and a marinade, both with Dr. Pepper. And they're wonderful. They're wonderful. You still get the you know, tomato-y, barbecue-y flavor, but the Dr. Pepper gives it just a wonderful different kind of taste that many people love. We have some friends that actually live in Manhattan, and for Christmas I sent them each a bottle of the barbecue sauce, and she said, we have to ration it. We love it so much. It's a great flavor.
Yeah. Yeah, I should have gotten that. I was I got the syrup. I'm
mm-hmm.
waiting to use it. I haven't gotten to use it yet.
Mm-hmm.
How did the name Dr. Pepper?
You know, that is one of the great mysteries. There are many stories as to why it was named Dr. Pepper. The most prevalent story is that it was, we do know that it was named by Dr. Morrison, who was the owner of the drugstore. The story goes that he worked for a Dr. Pepper in Virginia, which is true. He did work for Dr. Pepper in Virginia. The rumor is that he was in love with Dr. Pepper's daughter and that he wanted to marry her, but that Dr. Pepper said, you haven't made much of your life and you work a little harder, et cetera. So when he invented this drink, he named it Dr. Pepper in honor of him trying to win his favor. Research shows that Dr. Pepper did have a daughter, but she was a child. She was about 4 or 5 when he knew her, when he was there. So that's probably not why. One of the stories said that he named it Dr. Pepper after his horse. Of course, it used to be that carbonated soft drinks were medicinal, and so he could have named it Dr. Pepper for the medicinal properties that it had. But the true story is actually a mystery. We don't really know why it's named Dr. Pepper. That and the exact recipe are the two things that we don't know.
I understand it's like, somebody said, like, is it 23 flavors or something?
23 flavors. Yes, he mixed together the syrups that he had in the drugstore and hit upon one that he liked and thought tasted pretty good. And so we don't know exactly what's in it. We do know there's no prune juice in it. That rumor was started around the early 1900s. We think it was maybe invented by a competitor saying, oh, you don't want to drink that. It's got prune juice in it. But Dr. Pepper will confirm that, indeed, there is no prune juice in Dr. Pepper.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, rest assured.
Yeah. And also outside of the, in the parking lot, tell us what's in the parking lot.
In the courtyard area?
The courtyard, yeah.
Yeah, we have some old Dr. Pepper delivery vehicles out there. We have a 1954 delivery truck, and then we have a bulldog truck that's from the turn of the 1900s, the beginning of the 1900s. And then we have a wagon out there, all different vehicles and vehicle types that would have been used to deliver Dr. Pepper back in the day, as they say. And they're wonderful. They're fun to take your picture with.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Esther and Eunice got their picture taken.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to drive the 50s truck, but we don't anymore. It's not really street-worthy anymore, but they're all out there, and they're very fun to come and look at.
And what's, you got a website?
We do. It's drpeppermuseum.com, www.drpeppermuseum.com.
That's certainly easy enough to remember.
That's right. That's the name of the institute.
Okay. Well, it's great talking with you. I'm so glad you were able to call in.
Yeah, it's a wonderful visit.
Yeah, and I'll be a pepper too, maybe.
Wonderful, wonderful. And for all you folks out there, come see us. Heart of Texas, halfway between Dallas and Austin. So drop by when you're in the state.
Okay. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thanks so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. I'm a pepper, you're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper, too? Well, now that we peppered out, yes, there are mammoths in Waco. Aha. Aren't there? Mammoths in Waco? Is that what I got? I got the Waco Mammoth site?
Yes,
or
do
I have Armstrong? Huh? I do?
You have the Waco Mammoth site.
Oh, I want to make, okay. I had the order written down. I'm going, I hope I got this in the right order. Say hello to my audience.
Hello, audience. This is Anna Iserle.
Tell them who you are, what
huh?
you do.
Yes, Well, this is Anna Enderle, the program coordinator of the Waco Mammoth Site located in Waco, Texas, also where the Dr. Pepper Museum is.
Oh, cool.
But anyway, the Waco Mammoth Site is a paleontological site right here in Texas.
So tell us how this all got started.
Well, it got started quite a few years ago. In 1978, two guys by the names of Paul Barron and Eddie Bufkin were simply exploring out here. It was less developed than what it is today, and they basically ran across a bone, and they knew that there was something special about this bone. They often could see cow bones out and about, but they knew it wasn't that. It was larger. They took it to a nearby museum on Baylor campus, and they identified it as mammoth and then Columbian mammoth, and the excavations began and really continued over the next several decades on and off, and that's really how it got its beginnings.
And how many did they find, or what did they exactly find? I mean, they just found a bunch of bones and put it together, or...?
Nope, not exactly. Actually, No, we have about 24 mammoths that have been identified out here, and as they've uncovered them, they have removed some of the mammoths. Now, some of the mammoths are still here in situ, which is why we are the Waco Mammoth Site, but initially they uncovered around 19 mammoths. They basically moved those mammoths to the Mayborn Museum here in Waco for better preservation purposes because they were exposed to the elements. But as luck would have it, they ran across some more remains towards the end of that project and continued excavations, and now they decided not to remove those remains, and instead we have this beautiful dig shelter that was built by Katera Reed in Austin, Texas, and you can go in there and actually see the remains of several mammoths and an extinct camel, and they're in situ, so they're in place, so they're exactly where they were when they died thousands of years ago and where the archaeologists and paleontologists uncovered them several years ago.
What would you say if somebody said, what's a mammoth?
Yes. Well, it's a proboscidean. How about that? It's actually a myth.
I thought you were going to say that. I knew it.
Well, essentially, it belongs to the elephant family. And if you can imagine a really large elephant, that's what a Columbian mammoth looks like. And here we are special. We have Columbian mammoths versus the famous woolly mammoth that most people are familiar with. Woolly mammoths were here in the Americas as well, and they were cousins to the Columbian mammoths. Now, all mammoths have gone extinct, but their far-distant cousins, the elephants, are still going strong today.
So what would you say that these are like large versions of animals that exist today?
Yes, they were. Now, they lived during this fantastic epoch. Most people know it as the Ice Age, which started about 2.5 million years ago, ended about 10,000 years ago. And during this time period, we had roaming around the world and Waco, Texas, what's called megafauna. So essentially we had super-sized versions of many animals that we have today. And so a mammoth is no different, really, than a super-sized elephant with a few other modifications. But we had things here like the giant ground sloth, which is a super-sized version of our small sloth today. This giant ground sloth was about 20 feet tall on its hind legs, and we had the glyptodont, which is a large armadillo, really the same size as a Volkswagen Beetle today. And so you can think of it that way. They had small changes, but they were really large versions of things you do see today.
Why do you think they shrunk?
That is a difficult question to answer. There's a lot of reasons why they shrunk, essentially. But a lot of things happened between now and then. The end of the Ice Age happened, and with the retreat of the ice sheets, and there was a lot of climatic changes going on, and people were coming in and starting to farm and hunt, and then we had the spread of disease, and all of these things that were going on at the same time kind of put pressure on some of these large animals, and they just really couldn't survive at the size that they were. And, you know, to get an idea of that, the mammoth itself that we have the remains of here at the Waco Mammoth Site, a healthy adult male could probably stand up to about 14 feet tall, like a look into the window of a second-story building, weighed about 10 tons, which is 20,000 pounds, and so they were large, and the environment just wasn't able to necessarily support them anymore. And so a lot of those animals went extinct. But other versions, other cousins, are still alive that are much smaller and can more easily survive in the environment that it changed over to. So
I also understand, like, they were able to tell the difference between a male and a female mammoth?
Sure.
From the bones.
As opposed
to their genitals, you know what I mean?
Well, it's sort of, you know, the same principle that, you know, forensic anthropologists can apply, or bioarchaeologists, we can tell from the pelvis. There's certain changes that happen between males and females, you know, to allow for childbirth in females, and that changes the shape of the pelvis. And there's also other things that can help us identify male from female. And really, we use this term called gracile versus robust. And males are usually more robust. They have bigger features and sturdier features versus the females, which are more graceful, I guess you could say. And so all that together, you can start to weed out the males from the females. And interestingly, here at the Waco Mammoth Site, we only have one male, and the rest of about the 24 mammoths are females or juveniles.
Oh. Yeah. Now, when they did this, when I was looking at one of the mammoths,
mm-hmm.
was it the composition of that mammoth, or versus, let's say, they found bones and then they kind of put together something and it looks like what it was?
Nope, exactly as you saw it laying there is exactly how it was when it died. It laid there in a similar position, whether it started resting there from, you know, as the water went away, or just they were trying to get out of the ravine, and they came to rest sort of in that position. And then over years, they were slowly covered up with soil. What we have here is a lot of flood events going on, and so they were covered up with the soil. And then the archaeologists and paleontologists did a great job in preserving their position. So there's only been very minimal reconstruction, and it's not changed the position of any of the bones at all. It's just been on-site reconstruction of certain bones to make them that were crushed, basically, and, you know, piece some of them back together. But they haven't been moved at all. And so we have this word that we use in archaeology called in situ. And it's a special word because we can actually show our visitors how they were when they died and how they were positioned. And that helps us to tell the story of what was going on that fateful day. Or we actually have several floods here. And it also helps explain what was going on. Maybe we can hypothesize.
So now, first, what even made these guys even think that there were mammoths there, or were they just going, I don't know, what do you want to do? Let's get a couple of shovels and just start digging here for the heck of it.
Right. Well, actually, they weren't looking for mammoths at all. It was just by chance, which is, you know, it's remarkable. They were exploring. I think they were, you know, hunting snakes, something like that. They were young guys, just out sort of having fun. And the first bone that was discovered was actually sticking out of the side of a ravine, which often happens in archaeology and paleontology. It's how the first bones are typically discovered, as we have different weather events, rain, wind, it uncovers soil and sort of eats away at the side of that ravine. And over time, it will expose bones that have been covered up thousands of years ago. So that's what happened here. A bone had essentially been uncovered, probably from weather events, and they saw it and took it. So no shovels involved. they were just able to basically pull it out of the ravine and take it to the museum.
Wow.
For identification, yeah.
Now, you had mentioned the other site where you can see some of the mammoths.
The first, the nursery herd that was originally discovered here, and I should backtrack a little bit and explain when they first found that bone, and they started excavations, they uncovered a Colombian mammoth nursery herd, which is made up of all females and their juveniles. And so that's a very special find, and that's actually one of the main reasons we're here today and what puts us on the map, because we're the only nursery herd in the Americas, and we're the second largest nursery herd in the world that has been discovered. And so there's a lot of information that we can get from that. We can look at herd behavior, possibly, from looking at the position of the remains and how they were situated. We can look at herd health overall to see how they were doing as they were trying to adapt to their environment or find food. And so those mammoths were taken to the Mayborn Museum today, which is part of Baylor University here in Waco, Texas. And but they're actually in storage, so you can't really see them yet. They're still being studied because there's a lot of important information and a lot of reconstruction that still needs to be done on those mammoths. Luckily, when they found more remains unexpectedly during the process of removing that nursery herd, they found more. And so essentially what we have here at the Waco Mammoth Site inside the dig shelter, you can see the evidence from three different flood events. So you can see a few more mammoths from that nursery herd. Then you can see another flood event. And this is, you can also see it in the soil. It's called stratigraphy. And so the different layers or different colors in the soil, which is evidence of different floods that came in. And so we have this other flood that came through that has some unidentified ribs in there from some mammal. We're not sure what mammal it's from, and it was associated with a baby tooth from a saber-toothed cat. So we have right there, we have this nursery herd of mammoths, which also, by chance, has the remains of an extinct American camel. A lot of people don't know we had camels here in the Americas thousands of years ago, but we did. So here we are. We have the camel mixed in with the nursery herd, and then this other flood that came through, and then a third flood. And the bones that you got to see was our big bull mammoth, the only male that we have here. And that came from a flood that was thousands of years later after that initial flood that involved the nursery herd. And so those are remains that you can see. So you can see part of the nursery herd. But originally, you know, a lot of those were removed and they're in storage and not out on display. So the main display is right here at the Waco Mammoth Site, where you can see these remains from these different floods that happened, you know, approximately 70,000 years ago.
Right. That's pretty cool.
It is.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And you also have a visitor center gift shop?
We do. When visitors first get here to the Waco Mammoth Site, you come into our welcome center where, you know, you can purchase tickets for the tour, because everyone goes on a walking guided tour. But inside we also have gifts and souvenirs that you can purchase. We have some fantastic Waco Mammoth Site T-shirts, and we have a lot of other fun things. We have plush mammoth camels and little figures. But, of course, we also have the magnets, pencils, pens, and books, a lot of neat children's books. We also focus on geology, since paleontology is a subdiscipline of geology. So we have a lot of neat things that focus on rocks and gems, minerals, and things of that nature.
Do you have anything that describes the mammoths at the site?
We do. We have a book that was produced by the Mayborn Museum and written by Jill Barrow specifically about our site. It also has a DVD inside of it that was produced. It tells you a little bit about our site as well and the mammoths.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of our biggest sellers, definitely.
Huh. I should have gotten one of that.
Well, you should have. It's a great little book.
Yeah.
We like it.
So, now, as far as yourself, do you have a background in what? Or
nope.
Just PR?
Nope. I'm actually a registered professional archaeologist with a specialty in human mortuary practices and health and nutrition. My background is actually in Maya archaeology, as well as Texas prehistoric archaeology, and I am also a certified interpretive guide, which essentially means I've learned to take the facts and turn them into a story and present it to people to get everyone interested in the subject matter and educated in fun ways instead of boring ways. And I'm also an adjunct. I teach at junior colleges anthropology classes.
Cool.
I have a long list of
yeah.
hats that I wear.
So have you gone, you've done a lot of diggings yourself?
I have definitely done quite a bit of digging. I was an archaeologist for years and owned my own company at one point. And so I've done some digs mostly here in Texas, specializing in Houston, the Houston area. So.
What was the most interesting things you've come across
in
the digging?
Yeah, well, the most interesting thing that I've done, so to speak, was my times spent in Honduras studying a pre-classic Maya population where I was essentially looking at how they were adapting to their environment. So I was looking at their health and so their bones for indicators of how well they were doing. As far as digging, I've excavated, multiple types of sites. But for an archaeologist, what's interesting to us is usually not that interesting to a lot of people that watch all these interesting shows on TV anymore. So one of my, I think, favorite finds, which sounds crazy, was a blue trade bead in San Saba, Texas, which just essentially indicated people coming in from Meso and South America, and it was just evidence of them being here and setting up missions in forts as they interacted with the American Indians several hundred years ago.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's a way of dealing with history that's not out of a book.
Exactly,
I guess,
it is.
With
that's
some reality.
Right. That's what I love about it. That's what I love.
Wow. Do you ever do, on the TV, do you ever do stuff like the cops call you in and ask you, what's this?
No, that would be pretty much a forensic anthropologist. And yeah, I don't do that side of it, but I like thousands of years old, thousands. So, and that's one reason I'm here at the Waco Mammoth Site. I've got this list of archaeology and interpretive experience and passion about the subject matter. And so that's why I'm here and having a great time working with the mammoths and teaching our visitors about the mammoths. We just completed our first year. Did you know that?
Wow.
Yeah. We've been open about 13 months now. And so we have our first year under our belt, and we had almost 29,000 people come through here in our first year. So I've been able to hopefully influence that many people about preservation and the Ice Age and all the animals that lived in it and about our mammoths.
So what's the admission charge?
It's $7 for adults, $6 for seniors, and our senior age is 60 years and up, and $5 for children between the ages of 4 and 12, and 3 and under are free. And we also offer a group rate, so groups of 20 or more that are paying on one receipt get $1 off each admission, and so we offer that as well. We often do full groups.
But you can't go on your own, I guess, right? I mean,
Definitely. You have options when you come here. We offer the guided walking tour, which we feel is pretty important. We give a lot of information. We definitely like interacting with our tours. I have tour guides here. They're also passionate about the subject matter. But for those that just want to go on their own pace and enjoy maybe the the park as it is. We have a self-guided tour sheet that we give them that has some important facts about our site. And you can just kind of go on your own. And so we have people that come out here and they'll go on a tour. And then we have some that might just walk to the dig shelter and hang out for a little while. We usually have a tour guide in the dig shelter as well, or a docent, and they can interact and get some information using from that situation. And some go on their own, come back, and go on a tour. We also show a film in our Welcome Center, the one from the book that we sell. And so you can also spend time watching that. And so you have options out here. We often have families come out and have a picnic. We have a small picnic area, and people are definitely taking advantage of that in the pretty weather. And not in
the picnic
this month, but
in the picnic area, people don't like eat chicken and just like leave the bones there as a joke, do they?
No chicken consumption.
Okay.
No. Esther and Eunice, they're safe if they were, to visit again. And so we actually have school groups that go out there too and use that space, and it's a nice space. It's nestled in the trees, and it's very pretty here in the spring. So people definitely respect our site. So.
Oh, that's good to know.
It is. It's good.
So now, just want to get clear, because I didn't get to the Mayborn Museum complex.
Mm-hmm.
Is from what I saw, I guess on a website, there's something like they have, like you're standing over something to look at it?
Yes, they did. In the mid-90s, they actually came out here and made one of the largest casts, I think, known, of the bull mammoth and the female and the juvenile that's basically laying over the male's tusk. And they created this fantastic exhibit out there at the Mayborn Museum. And you can go out, and it's covered in glass. It's under the floor, glass floor, so you can walk on top of it, essentially. And you can look down and really get the detail. I enjoy the exhibit very much. Go out there now and then, and I'll go to the exhibit and just stand over the cast, which looks absolutely realistic, and look at the details of the mammoths from that perspective. It's a neat perspective. And the Mayborn Museum is our good friend, and we're here. They're over the science here, although we're run by the city of Waco. And they're a dear friend of ours, and so we enjoy going out there to that exhibit.
So the museum, is there an admission charge for the museum?
There is an admission charge to that museum. So,
okay. I guess it's more than just the seeing a mammoth.
It is. It includes the entire museum, and they have a fantastic museum over there. So definitely recommend people visiting the Mayborn Museum and the Waco Mammoth site.
Oh, okay. How about the website? You got a website?
We do. We have a website. It's wacomammoth.com.
That's so far, this has been easy. The last one, it was drpeppermuseum.com. Waco Mammoth site. .com.
it's just Waco Mammoth. It's even shorter.
WacoMammoth.com.
Or .org. We have both.
Oh, okay.
So, we have both. And we have a website, and we also have a Facebook page. So we encourage everyone to follow our Facebook page as well.
Okay. Well, it's great having you on the show. Did I miss anything, by the way?
Wow, I don't think so.
Okay.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, I just want to make sure we got all the info in.
I think so. I think we held just enough back that people will come out here and still learn something new. So.
Yeah, you just never know what
never
you're going to find when you travel to the places.
No, you don't.
Yep. All right, thanks so much for calling and sharing all this information with us.
No problem. Thank you, Merle.
Okay. And what's the weather there where you are, by the way?
Cold.
Okay.
Cold. Not
when you say cold.
Okay, a high of 42.
Well, it's colder in New York. Okay.
Yes.
But I still, it actually was hysterical because when I went out there, I'm thinking, oh, it's going to be so much warmer than New York. And I'm going, what warmer? I still needed my winter jacket until I got to McAllen. And that was much better. And I went, oh, okay, it's warm. Not
you
hot,
were here during
warm.
A cold spell. Yeah.
Yeah, well, lucky me.
Lucky you.
I'm going off to Fort Lauderdale next week, and I really hope it's not going to be a cold spell there.
Hopefully not.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks again so much, and have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
And link this to your website so everybody
will
can. Okay.
We will.
Take care.
You too.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye. Yeah. Well, let's see. Okay. Time for another sponsor.
Thank you for calling JetBlue. May I help you?
My cousin was telling me you guys have extra leg room.
Uh-huh. We have extra leg room as compared to a normal coach seat.
Okay. If I don't have an extra leg, can I use that room for something else?
No. No, that is not what the extra leg implies. We took out one whole row of seats, and that gave the rest of those rows a couple of extra inches of leg room.
Ah.
I understand what you mean. The words extra leg imply that, but it has nothing to do with having an extra leg.
I'm a pretty literal person.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be taking it very literally.
I guess a little too literally.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with?
I think that's it. You've been pretty helpful.
Thanks for calling, JetBlue.
Dear traveler, stretch out. We now have the most legroom in coach. Visit us at JetBlue.com. Sincerely, JetBlue. Based on average fleet-wide seat pitch of U.S. Airlines.
Commercial is so cute. I'll be JetBlueing when I go to Fort Lauderdale. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, we've got a few minutes before our next caller. And I know I have to load up some more songs. And so I'm going to take a quick break right now.
We starve, look at one another, short of breath, walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smells from laboratories, facing a dying nation of moving paper fantasy, listening for the new toll lies with supreme visions of lonely tunes. Somewhere inside something there is a rush of greatness whom
Sunshine coming in here. No, I think it is shining a bit. But, okay. Well, I think now we're on to the Armstrong Browning Library. Is that who I got on the air at the moment?
Yes, this is Rita Patterson. I'm the director here at the library.
Without an R.
That's true.
And Patterson without the R.
That's it.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Oh, just fine here. So, okay. Let's begin with, I got to ask you, what's the relationship between the Armstrong Browning Library and Italy?
Well, the main reason that there is a connection is the focus that the library has on the Victorian poets Robert and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Now, we have the largest collection of Browning materials here at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And the Italian connection comes because the Brownings, who lived in London, married in London, soon went to Florence, Italy, and lived there during their married life, from 1846 to 1861, when Elizabeth died. And so there is that Italian connection. The library has some Italian features in the architecture. The front doors are styled after the Ghiberti baptistry doors from Florence. There is Italian marble columns in the MacLean Foyer of Meditation. There are ornate ceilings styled after some churches from Rome and Venice. So that's the main reason that there is an Italian connection. We have stained glass windows down on the ground floor, six windows that were done between 2000 and 2007. And they tell sort of the Italian story of the Brownings, with windows dedicated to Florence and Rome and Venice, Vallombrosa, Oslo. These are all places that the Brownings would visit and go to in Italy. So those are the reasons that we have the Italian connection.
Is there one particular thing regarding something with an angel?
Oh, right. Oh, good. I'm glad you thought of that. There is something called the Fano Club, and that was started by William Lyon Phelps, who was a Yale professor. Robert Browning wrote a poem called The Guardian Angel, A Picture at Fano, and William Lyon Phelps taught the Browning course, and he loved that poem, so he decided he would like to see the actual painting. And he took a small group to Fano, Italy, and he found the painting in a church there, and decided that it would be nice to have a very exclusive club that he would call the Fano Club. So they gathered up various postcards there in Fano, and his criteria was that if someone would see the painting and write a postcard to him and say that they had seen it and would like to be a member and mail it to him, they would become a member of the Fano Club. Unfortunately, that trip took place in 1912, and when they mailed their postcards, they mailed them, and they were going across on the Titanic. So, unfortunately, I guess those postcards disappeared, but the Fauno Club still continues. The members were not on the Titanic. And the club function was passed down to A.J. Armstrong, who was the founder of this collection here at Baylor. And the Fauno Club still goes on today. Today I get postcards almost, well, not monthly, but quite often during the year from people who have gone to Fauno. The picture is now in the Civic Museum there, and they see it and send me a postcard. And their perk for becoming a Fauno Club member is that they are invited to Waco, Texas for a free meal every May 7th, which is Robert Browning's birthday.
Oh. So now, but what is the thing that's in the, is there the one particular related stained glass window?
There is a window that shows the guardian angel. We have a copy of the painting that's in Fauno, and then there's a stained glass window in the research hall, which is one of our oldest windows. It was done in 1924. The building itself was built in 1951, but the collection started way back in 1918 when A.J. Armstrong gave his small collection to Baylor University.
Uh-huh. And let me ask you a question. Okay. Now, in as I toured, I mean, one of the things, I mean, my reaction was, look at all these great stained glass windows, and I'm not in a church.
Right.
Now,
right.
Now, from what I'm getting, on each stained glass window, there is a piece of, there is some part of poetry, correct?
On most of the windows, yes. There's either a line of poetry from either Elizabeth Barrett Browning or Robert Browning. And many of the windows were given in honor of a loved one or in memory of a loved one. We have 62 stained glass windows here in the building. And as I said, the oldest ones were done in 1924. There are three, the Guardian Angel, the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and How They Brought the Good News from Ghent to A. Then the rest of the windows, most of them were put into the building when it was created in the 50s. But there are newer windows that are in some of the offices on the third floor, and then the ones that I talked about, the Italian windows, were done on the ground floor quite recently. But, yeah, each one of them has a what we call a medallion in the middle that depicts some part of the poem that's depicted in the window. And most of the windows were done by Conic Studios in Boston, Massachusetts, but there have been other stained glass artisans from New York and Philadelphia and even Waco to do one. So it's really quite a magnificent building. I'm sorry I didn't see you when you came through. It would have been nice to talk to you.
Well, yeah. Ah, it's okay. I had a good time.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it.
So now, just so I understand, so when these stained glass windows get done,
mm-hmm.
are these people like who do them? Are they handed a photo of what the museum wants, or they're pretty much on their own to create something?
In the beginning, I believe Conic Studios, they would read the poem that had been selected as the centerpiece of the window. And they came up with the medallions and the symbols that are around the windows. Sometimes there are flowers, bells and pomegranates, because Robert Browning wrote a series of poems that were called Bells and Pomegranates. And then in the later windows, sometimes the donors themselves have contributed ideas as to what they want into the windows. But basically, it's the stained glass artisan that comes up with the design for the window.
So in other words, there, it's not like that the poem goes in as an afterthought.
No, it's usually the central start for the window, and everything that shows has something to do with the poem itself.
Okay. So I remember, so there was one particular room that had a whole bunch of stained glass windows. There was another room, well, actually, when you first come in, you got to see some stained glass windows there.
Right. There are three in that entrance hall.
And which also have poetry on it?
Yes.
Okay.
The three in there are Rabbi Ben Ezra, Abt Vogler, and Saul. Now, I'm sorry, I'm not going to remember the phrases that are on the windows, but the Rabbi Ben Ezra poem is famous for the line, "Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be." And you see that used widely in anniversary cards and various places.
Right.
And, of course, Elizabeth's, "How do I love thee, let me count the ways." That's another popular line that's used on many items. In the Elizabeth Barrett Browning Salon up on the third floor, the six or five windows that are in there all have lines from her sonnets from the Portuguese. And the last window is in honor of the 43rd sonnet. And so although it does not have the line, "How do I love thee," it has one of the other lines from the 43rd sonnet.
So give us a description of the salon.
Okay.
And I understand, by the way, you can't go up there on your own, right?
Well, normally during the week, we are open from 9 until 5 o'clock. And normally the salon is open. Now, on occasion on a Saturday, if someone would come in, because we are a little bit more shorthanded on Saturdays, sometimes that room is locked and you do have to ask in order to go inside it. But normally we have it standing open for people to go in and just view the room. And it's set up in a drawing room effect of what a Victorian living room might have looked like. Our room is not a replica of anything that the Brownings had, but we do have several pieces in there that belong to them. There are some little side chairs, olive wood chairs that belong to Elizabeth that were used in Casa Guidi in Florence. Oh, I had forgotten that as an Italian connection. When they did live in Florence, their home was called Casa Guidi, and it's an apartment that's very close to the Pitti Palace. And, of course, Elizabeth is buried in Florence as well. So all those connections, their son was born in Florence. They had only the one child. He later became a sculptor and an artist. And we have 8 of his paintings here. And now one piece of his sculpture. And I'm really happy to have that. He studied under Rodin. And just because it's new to the collection right now, it's standing in my office, and I'm really pleased to be able to see it almost every day when I come in. So all those Italian connections. So back to the salon. It has a little prayer stand that was once in the Brownings' home, a soft sofa table that was given to her by her grandmother, a bust of a Madonna that was once in their home, a fan that belonged to her. The room also houses our sheet music collection, where the Brownings' poetry has been set to music by a variety of composers, and we have about 1,500 pieces collected there. We collect their letters, their manuscripts, books from their library, likenesses of the Brownings, personal memorabilia of the Brownings. We have lots of their furniture, candlesticks, rings, you know, almost anything that you can think of, as well as the original materials that the scholars come here to use. So it's quite a place. We've got three floors to the building. Two of the floors do have collection items on them. And our ground floor is where our stack area is, where the books are stored. So I'm hoping that people will get an interest in coming to see the building, because it's just hard to describe. People who hear about, or just hear the phrase Armstrong Browning Library, can't appreciate exactly what the building is until they see it. Because Dr. Armstrong, when he was creating the building, used many ideas that he picked up as he traveled throughout Europe. Two of the ways that he had of raising money for the building was bringing celebrities to Baylor University, starting as early as 1914 and going through the 30s and 40s. And then the other way was conducting educational tours. He and his wife had one of the largest educational tour businesses in the early days, and they would take large groups to Europe, and they would see the places that the Brownings visited, where they lived. And as he saw those places, and just as he traveled around, he was picking up ideas for this building. So we've got marble floors and black walnut paneling, the beautiful columns.
Tell us about that door.
Oh, the entrance doors?
Yeah.
Well, they are bronze doors. They weigh 3/4 of a ton each. They are styled after the Ghiberti baptistry doors that are there in Florence. Those doors have passages from the Bible on them. These have 10 panels that depict poems of the Brownings. So those are the main entrance doors to the library, and they go into the Martin entrance foyer, where first you see the three large stained glass windows, and right in front of you is a painting of Robert Browning that was done by the son, a desk that belonged to Robert Browning. There are four busts in the room. One of the son, when he was about 10 years old, was done by Alexander Monroe, and another of John Kenyon, the person that we call kind of the matchmaker of the Brownings. John Kenyon was a distant cousin of Elizabeth's and a good friend of Robert Browning. And the way the Brownings got together in the first place was, she was already a well-known poet, and Robert Browning was an up-and-coming poet. Mm-hmm. She's 6 years older than he, and she had written a poem called Lady Geraldine's Courtship that appeared in her poems of 1840. And in that poem, she mentioned Robert Browning and paid him a very nice compliment because she enjoyed his poetry. Probably she was discussing this with John Kenyon, her cousin. Anyway, he passed it on to Robert Browning and said to him, you know, why don't you write her and thank her for this nice compliment she's paid you? And Robert Browning did. January the 10th of 1845, he wrote his very first letter to Elizabeth Barrett, and started it out by saying, I love your verses. Wrote for, I don't know, several pages, and wound up the letter with saying, and I love you too. And I just think that's unusual for someone to go that far in a very first letter and to say that to someone they had never met, and sort of surprised that she even responded. But they did. They carried on correspondence for several months before they even met. And eventually she allowed him to come to 50 Wimble Street. And it's kind of, that's, now you know the rest of the story.
Yeah. That's really cool. Now, let me ask you, you have a gift shop.
Yes.
Now, is there something that depicts, like, a book or something that depicts all of the stained glass windows?
We have a book that we call it our souvenir book. It doesn't have all of the windows, but it has a good many of them. It's a nice souvenir book, and we have it for sale in the gift shop. Other Victorian kind of memorabilia pieces. We have a little paperweight that has the clasped hands of the Brownings showing on the top of them. In the McLean Foyer of Meditation, there is a bronze cast. It's showing a life-size version of the Brownings as they were holding hands. And that was done by Harriet Hosmer in 1853. So that's the focal point of the McLean Foyer of Meditation. And I don't know if you remember that room. It's a beautiful room that is widely used here in the library for musical events. Chamber singers, the Baylor Group, comes over and does their spring and Christmas concerts here. And anyway, the paperweight is for sale in the gift gallery, as well as many other Browning books and various items.
I took a photo of the ceiling. I took a photo of the ceiling that's in the meditation room.
Right.
And it's on my blog.
Oh, okay. The ceiling is a 23-karat gold leaf that was applied into wet plaster. So, as I say, this building is just very difficult to describe. You just have to come see it. And I hope everybody that's listening out there will come see us at some point.
So let's get this. In terms of location, this is on the campus of the Baylor...
It's Baylor University.
Baylor University.
Waco, Texas. Mm-hmm. We are on the corner of 8th and Spate Streets. And it's very easy to find. And there are visitor spots around, so it's really quite easy to get to. We're just off of the Interstate 35. Waco is halfway between Dallas and Austin, so it's easily accessible.
Okay, that's great. And website?
Yes, www.browninglibrary.org, O-R-G.
Okay, that's fabulous. Now, let's see, did I miss anything?
Oh, my goodness. Well, what I would like to say is that in 2012, it's going to be the bicentennial of Robert Browning's birth, and that will also be the centennial of when A.J. Armstrong came to Baylor University. So we'll be doing several events during that year, and just watch our website. We'll have more information about that. And something that's coming up very shortly is on February the 12th, we'll be having a Valentine, what we call extravaganza here. And it's from 4 to 6 o'clock on February the 12th. And it's a fellow named Dave Tanner from Dallas who sings and plays the piano, and he'll be doing Broadway love songs. So because of Valentine's Day, because of the courtship and love story of the Brownings. We kind of play up Valentine's here.
Oh, yeah, I bet. That's a perfect place.
Yeah.
That's really great. That's a great idea. I'm going to get in touch with you afterwards to talk to you about, I have a newspaper, an Italian-American newspaper.
Okay.
That I'm writing for. And I know I got I didn't get it yet. Everything's still being mailed to me from Waco.
Oh.
And it was a book, you know, Italy, of the connection.
Uh-huh.
But I was kind of wondering if, because I wanted to get something so I can detail my writing in regards to the stained glass windows.
Okay.
If you have something.
Okay. We have We have an older publication that I could get to you.
That would be great. Because I'd like to kind of do as much describing as possible, and especially like because I have publications where I'm not limited to the amount of words,
mm-hmm.
so I can be as descriptive as I want.
So, is your address on your website or something?
No, I'll call you because I'm not going to announce. You realize if I announce my address on the air, everybody from the entire world is going to come to my house to visit me.
I understand.
And I beg, you know. did I ask you if there's an admission charge?
No, it's free admission, so
please
come.
That's really cool.
Yes, it is.
And are people allowed to take photos?
We prefer that you take them without flash. You can take photos, but without flash.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, actually, when it comes to the windows, if they're windows, I mean, like if you get enough light.
Right. Yeah, the windows normally come out very well, and even better when it's a little bit cloudy outside because direct sunlight it just too bright, but
that's true.
Really beautiful. Yeah. So
if you're in Waco on a cloudy day, you know where to go.
That's it.
That's fabulous. I really appreciate you calling in and talking with us about
we're always happy to share our information and look forward to having quite a few people come in. We have visiting scholars. We have a visiting scholar program. Right now we have a lady from Washington State who is here and doing work on Elizabeth Barrett Browning. So,
I just want to ask you a question before I forget. And you do have, you can purchase, books of the poetry there?
Yes.
Okay.
We do have that, and of course,
anyone
can come in and use our resources as well.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
We're happy to have you.
Yeah. Okay, that's fabulous. All right, again, thank you for calling in and sharing all this with us.
Well, you're very welcome.
And then you'll get to read it. At least it's up on the blog.
Okay.
On both blogs.
All right.
So now I'll start getting it transferred eventually into the publications.
Very good. Well, it was nice to talk to you.
Have a great day.
Well, thanks.
And
you
don't,
too.
And don't freeze where you are.
Oh, we're trying not to.
Yeah. Okay. Remember it's colder here.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. I found it, I hate keeping using the word interesting all the time, but for lack of a word, it's like you go to places, and this is what's so cool, because you you go to a place and you just, like, never know, you know, what's going to be there. And in a city that's not the most talked about city, you know, and you can find some great stuff. It's like, you know, heck, it's like if you went to, like if you went to McAllen, for instance. I mean, who knows what, you know, McAllen, right? And you just never know what's there. Is that true? Is that true? Nancy, what have you there?
Oh, I'm here. Yes, hi.
Yeah.
It's true. If you're not a
that was my segue into it.
Sorry, a little funny up there. If you're not a potential winter Texan, which is what we affectionately call our snowbirds, or you're not a birder, a nature tourist, it's possible that you've never even considered visiting McAllen. But I'll tell you, we've got a lot going on down here. And I say down here because we're at the very tip end of Texas on the border with Mexico. And we've got a growing city. It's rated one of the top growing cities in the country for the last 20 years in a row. So lots and lots happening down here.
All right. Oh, yeah, we didn't introduce you, did we? Ah, tell my audience who we are. Who the hell you are.
Okay. I'm Nancy Millar. I'm the director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau here from McAllen, and it's the job of the Convention and Visitors Bureau to let people know about McAllen and all the wonderful tourist opportunities there are here.
Yeah, and you schlepped me around for a whole day.
Oh, while. Not long enough, Merle, not long enough.
Yeah, I know. Well, what I wanted to kind of get into, because, like, since I'm not going to have, like, every single place on my radio show, is some of the places that I want to just kind of, like, that we kind of popped around. Like for instance, I never did get to talk about, the Drury Suites Hotel, which was a great spot. I mean, a great hotel.
Yeah, that really is a nice hotel. We've got 36 hotels in McAllen, so we've got plenty, all the way from budget to full service, and we've got pretty much all the name brands. Drury Suites is it's a very nice hotel, and it's located right on the expressway, just about in the middle of the city. So it's well situated for people who want to do a little bit of everything. And as the name implies, it's an all suite hotel. They've got 89 rooms. They've got a full breakfast that comes with the room every morning, which I can tell you from personal experience is very good. I've enjoyed it before. Now, this is a little thing, but it really gets me. When you walk in, the place smells like popcorn because they have a popcorn machine that they offer free popcorn to their guests too, and it's one of my favorite treats. So I love that place.
They have I don't know if you want to call it a business center. It's like a cubicle.
Yeah. Well, for people who don't.
One of which has a computer with a printer.
Right, yeah, for people who either don't travel with a laptop or just choose for whatever reason not to use their own, and that's available to everybody. And it's got a small meeting room in it, and I've had meetings in there before with, you know, 4, 5, 6 people. If you just want to, let's say, you know, you want to meet somebody who lives in McAllen, you're down for a visit, and you just want to have a quick, hi, how you doing kind of thing, you can have your privacy there. It's got washer and dryer, which is really nice. You can take care of, you know, cleaning your clothes if you're planning on staying for a while. It's got several restaurants within walking distance. As a matter of fact, it's right next door to an Olive Garden. So it really is a very convenient hotel.
Yeah, and nice. And the people are nice, too.
Yeah. Well, I have to brag. That is one of our specialties, is the people down here. And it's true. I'm not from here originally, although I've been here for about 25 years. But my husband and I moved around a lot before we settled in McAllen. And I swear this is true. Every time we move someplace, someone would say to us, oh, you're going to love it here. It's the people who make the difference. This is the only place where we felt like that was really true of all the different places we've lived. So when we got down here, we just didn't want to leave. The people are amazing, and I don't know why. It's just that McAllen has attracted these incredibly warm and friendly people.
Well, I enjoyed myself. I had friendly people with me all the time.
Yeah, I tell you, they're everywhere.
I have to say that I didn't, although, you know, with the breakfast, and also they have the, well, I guess the manager's kind of, I call it the, I guess, like a happy hour type thing where this food comes out as well.
Right.
You really can just eat, if you want, you can wind up just having breakfast and dinner there for nothing if you didn't want to take in the places. But what was interesting was that, like, the first place we went to, I mean, we had breakfast at El Pato.
Oh, yes, El Pato.
And tell us about that this whole concept. It's like, because I would kind of call it a upscale Taco Bell.
Yeah, you know, that's probably a good comparison in a lot of ways. It's really a wonderful story. Back many years ago, there was a lady named Mrs. Gonzalez, and she made a mean tortilla. Down here, we get fresh, real, delicious tortillas because people, you know, I mean, that's part of the culture. Because we're so close to Mexico, the area is very heavily Hispanic. So we, honestly, my feeling is that this is the best of both worlds right here. We get the mixture of the warmth and the kindness and the generosity of the Mexican people with the best attributes of the United States people too, which I think in a lot of ways are offering opportunities and things like that. So it's a fantastic place to live, and part of that is the food. Part of it definitely is the food, but
yeah.
we have lots of places that serve tortillas. Well, Mrs. Gonzalez had opened up just a little hole-in-the-wall place where she would make tortillas and sell them, and what was happening is they were so good that as she would sell them, people started eating them on the spot. And so she just put a little table outside of her place, and it became more and more popular, and it kind of grew from there. So now it's a local chain. There are 23 of them around the region, and El Pato, which means duck, has become a real. Their little saying is it's a valley tradition. This area is called the Rio Grande Valley, and it's true. My daughter comes home from college, and she says, "Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Let's go to El Pato." when kids leave to go to college, that's one of the main things that they miss. Matter of fact, I'm under strict orders anytime I visit her to take her some El Pato refried beans and tortillas. So, yeah, it's seriously good. So anyway, so there are 23 of them, and each one, while they all look similar, each one has been decorated by actually a local artist with serious Mexican flair and different pieces of what could almost be described as folk art on the walls. So you've got this wonderful, really kind of mini experience of Mexican culture when you go into one of these. And then there's the food, and the tortillas are just really, truly the best tortillas I've ever had. The idea is you stuff them full of anything that you want. They give you a long list of different fillings, and you pick the ones you want, so you're custom making your own. They have regular plates of food also, but very popular are the tatos, which is what they're called.
And then there's that little island of
condiments. Yes, like add-ons, like pico de gallo, and I don't think they have guacamole there, but they have salsa and onions and just different things that you may or may not want to add on to your dish. So I can't remember what you had, Merle.
I had the scrambled eggs.
Ah, okay. And I had a pato because I just love their patos there. Biting into one of those tortillas is just like going to heaven. It's just so good. that's right. And we got you one, didn't we, with butter on it.
Yeah.
Really, really
then
good.
We also the thing about the shopping. Well, what do they call it? What's the phrase?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is very, very cool. McAllen is extremely well known in the country of Mexico. We're known for our shopping. We are actually the number one shopping destination in the entire United States for the country of Mexico. People come over here literally by the millions every year from Mexico to shop. And so we've got lots and lots of shopping here, way more than we should for a city of our size, which, you know, of course, the locals love that. But it's so popular that in Monterrey, which is the closest large city to us, Monterrey, Mexico, it's got about almost 4 million people in it, they've made up a phrase that means, let's go shopping in McAllen. And they say vamos McAllenando, which means let's go McAlleninning, or let's go shopping
right.
in McAllen. It's McAlleniando, yeah. They've actually made that word up. So that we're really well known for our great shopping.
Well, what to expect is there's like it's not like little local stores, but there are, but
yeah. Yeah, the Mexican nationals, a lot of times they come for the chains that we have here. And we've got, you know, a lot of the big shopping chains that you would expect, Macy's and Dillard's and Banana Republic and Gap and Ann Taylor and just all those. And we also do have some specialty, a lot of specialty shops, actually. We've just got a lot of everything because of that. Because of all these shoppers who come over, because of all the Mexican nationals that come over, we've got all this shopping. And that's a lot of the reason that we have so many wonderful restaurants, too, because they'll come over and they'll shop, 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 eat, shop, shop some more, and then go home. So the locals really benefit by a huge array of different kinds of food and shopping opportunities. So we love it.
Mm.
Yeah, boy. It's good,
I'm getting
good
hungry
stuff both
now.
Ways. The best, let me tell you, the best Tex-Mex, I mean authentic Tex-Mex, plus we've got the whole Texas barbecue thing going on down here, plus we've got really fresh seafood because we're close to the ocean. So, yeah, we've really got a lot of good. A lot of Asian food down here, too. Just a lot of everything.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And before I get to the food thing, I want to comment about that place, that bead place.
The
place
where
we got the beads?
Oh, the beads. Oh, yeah. Well, one of my hobbies is making jewelry, and so I've kind of checked out all the bead stores in town. And Merle and I went and visited one of my favorite ones, and I picked up a few things. I think, Merle, you picked up a few things. But it's.
I got the strands of the magnetic beads.
Ah, yes, that's right, that's right. And I think I got some pearls. I can't remember now. I shouldn't admit this in case my husband listens to this, but I go into bead shops pretty often, and I've been a couple of three times since you and I were there. I can't remember what I bought then. But yeah, we have a number of bead shops here. And each of them has a specialty. There's one place that has a lot of the crystals, and another place that does a lot of sterling, another place that does a lot of the pearls, things like that. But the one where we went, Merle, I think was a pretty well-rounded one. They had a little bit of everything. Well, actually,
yeah.
They had a lot of everything.
Well, I had never seen magnetic beads before, and I understand it's good for arthritis.
Yeah, that's that. That's right. Actually, what magnets do is they help increase the circulation of the blood, which helps and increased blood flow helps arthritis. So that's why it works so well. But a lot of people wear like magnetic bracelets and things like that. Yep.
Yeah, I'm going to try to make something, or I'll have somebody make something for me. Also, the couple of restaurants that I wanted to mention. First of all, the other place we had breakfast, the Spanish Room.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of times when you go to a hotel, their restaurants are adequate at best.
Yeah.
They're nothing that you would necessarily write home about. But we've got a few hotels here that have restaurants that are just so superior that I love to take visitors to them. And the one where you and I went, Merle, was called the Spanish Room, which is the restaurant in the Renaissance Casa de Palmas Hotel, which is our historic hotel in town. And the Spanish Room is one of my favorite places to eat in town. They especially for breakfast. As a matter of fact, I was there this morning because they do such just a really bang up job with their menus are creative and absolutely delicious. Let's see, I know what I
and
had.
And noticed for the migas.
Yes, I always have the migas. As a matter of fact, I have the migas so often that I, when I go in, the wait staff doesn't even hand me a menu anymore. They know. Migas are...
Tell us what it is, what migas
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's scrambled eggs with bits of crispy tortilla chips in it, and a lot of times it also has some spices in it, like cilantro or maybe some tomatoes and onions and some chili. And it's just wonderful. One of my favorite things to eat. That and the hot tea, and I'm set. I'm good for the day. And you didn't have the migas. You tried it, but you did. You had something else. I'm drawing a blank now.
I got to look at the photos.
Oh,
to
yeah.
Remember. I didn't have lox and bagels, did I? No.
No, you didn't.
No, I didn't have that. I remember it was something I had that you were able to taste.
Oh, okay.
Meaning
that
it didn't have any, meaning it was vegetarian.
Right. Yeah. Right, but you did try my
meat. Oh, I know. I had the... what do you call it? French toast.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. And it was good. It's the first time I had tried the French toast there because, like I said, I always get the migas. But, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway.
Yes.
They do have bagels, lox and bagels there. But
yeah.
Yeah.
And I
they
thought,
do have
I'm not going to have lox and bagels on my ear, you know.
Yeah, you have that at home.
Yeah.
But
one other restaurant we went to was, the Patio Anguera.
Oh, the Patio Anguera, yeah. That
Anguera,
is actually,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. It's got that U in it, so it looks like it could be Guerra, but it's pronounced Guerra. This is an interesting story, actually. The building that this restaurant is in, it's in our historic area, in our downtown area, and it has been in the same family for generations. And it used to be a drugstore, a five and dime, and now it's a restaurant. And it was just closed. It was just shuttered for a while, and then the current generation decided they were just going to do something with it. So they opened, they renovated it. These buildings were built in like 1910 along this street, and the whole street actually has been renovated. It's our entertainment district now. Within the last 2 years, we've had 36 bars, nightclubs, lounges, and restaurants open up on this street. So it has become the entertainment spot for the entire region. People come from miles around when they want to have an evening out. And this is one of the anchors of that whole area. It's such a beautiful restaurant. But it's got the exposed brick because they left it very much, or they restored it to very much like it was when it was first built. And it's really lovely. You go in through a patio, thus the name, and which is open to the sky, and you can actually eat outdoors if you like. And then, of course, there's the interior part, too, which is larger, which has a bar inside, and then the white linen cloth tables. And they serve excellent, excellent cuisine. It has only been open for about 2 years, a little bit less, I think, and is already one of the most popular places in town. Now, I do remember you had steak there. And I had fettuccine Alfredo, which was amazing. A lovely.
And we also started off with those fried olives.
That's right, those fried olives that were so good. And I had just, you know, before you came down, Merle, I had never had fried olives. So you've introduced me to something new. So they were fried, and then I think were they stuffed with cheese?
No, that was the other place.
Oh, the other place. Okay, these were just fried, and the green olives. Yeah, and the combination of the fry and the kind of the
tanginess, if you want to call it.
Tanginess, that's a good word, yeah, of the olives. Was really a nice combination, very interesting combination. But, yeah, that was a really nice place. Now, that area, it's on 17th Street. Oh, so I was going to tell you about that. So, anyway, so the road is called 17th Street, but back in the day, it used to be called Guerra Street after this family, and which they lived above above the store, as did many families back in those days. And there were two other families named Guerra that also lived on that same street, all three of them unrelated, but it's a fairly common name down here. So there were three families down there, and they all lived on, so they called it Guerra. After a while, everybody moved away, it was renamed whenever they numbered the streets. But when they opened the restaurant, that's why they called it the Patio on Guerra, to refer back to their the beginnings of their family's history with McAllen.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So that was so that's the area that's the entertainment district.
Right.
Right.
Yes, and we you can just walk up and down the streets if you like, and stop by in any place that looks interesting, any restaurant or lounge or bar, and there's just about any kind of music you can think of you can find down there, or you can grab one of the pedicabs, one of the bicycle taxis, and zip around the street that way. So it's a lot of fun, and that's where the action is, especially on the weekends.
Now, we also went, as far as the shopping, we also went to, a place that was, nearer to the border, and it was shopping for Mexican stuff.
Yeah. There are two stores that are just this side, maybe 200 yards from, maybe 300, I'm really bad with distances, but not far at all from the bridge that goes into Mexico from the border.
Mm-hmm.
And they're right across the street from each other. And one of them is called Mexcrafts, and the other one is called Gabby's. And they are full of items from Mexico. It's like being there. It's got a little bit of everything in there. And it's got calavera. It's got all kinds of little souvenir kind of things. It's got outdoor pots and other outdoor furniture and such. Just everything, all kinds of plates and dishes and bowls and vases. And you got some vanilla there. I got some swizzle sticks with little critters on top, glass swizzle sticks that had little birds or little turtles and little things like that on top of them. Just everything you can imagine. And then Gabby's across the street, also has a lot of things. They have more clothing and jewelry, although they also have the pots and vases and,
right.
and home decor items. But the two together really give you a good taste of the kind of craftsmanship that is done in Mexico.
Yeah, I got a necklace, a nice sterling silver necklace.
Right, that's right. Yeah.
That's what I needed, as opposed to looking at the stuff and going, I'm not schlepping this home.
Right. You could wear it home. Those are wonderful stores.
Yeah, so you can, the shopping-wise, you could either do American style or Mexican style, either one, while you're there.
That's exactly right, and a lot of people do. One of the cool things about Mexico is that you can get, if you're into cooking, you can get these giant, quart bottles of vanilla for very, very cheap prices, and a lot of people do. They'll come down here and load up on vanilla if the winter Texans, for instance, before they go home, and then use it, and it'll last all year until they come back the next year. And if memory serves, I think you bought some vanilla, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And there's some sign on it, like, was there something like with a cow or something, saying that there's something that's not used in there?
Oh, yes, and I remember that lady telling us, but I can't remember the story. But anyway, it's the good vanilla. It's the quality vanilla.
Yeah, it's the good stuff.
Yeah, it's the good stuff. And
What I wound up doing is I got two bottles, and I gave one to a friend of mine, and she already used it and said how great it tasted. I said, oh, good, all right, at least I know.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's a great gift because, boy, you buy, vanilla in the grocery store and you get this one little old bottle. It's expensive stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But, let's see. I think I'm going to get the rest covered on maybe, like, my next show. Still got places, including actually what's, to me, like, what is kind of humorous. Of going to a sushi restaurant, and they're all Mexicans that are working there. No Asians.
Oh, yeah.
And yet everything is just fine. Tastes great.
Yeah,
but,
well, I guess if you think about it, that struck me funny, too, when I first got down here. But I guess if you think about it, it's no more funny than Americans figuring out how to make Asian food.
This is true. This is true as well. Well, the show's going to end in about a minute, so I'm going to have to cut you off. But I may have you back on again when I'm talking with the other places.
Okay,
so,
wonderful. Well, it's always a pleasure to visit with you, Merle.
And that was a great Vipers game, too.
Oh, yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
Well, Nancy, have a great, fabulous day, and I'll be in touch with you. And, enjoy the weather you have.
Okay, wonderful. Enjoy. Well, we will. We are enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, take it easy.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so it's time to end the show, and I think I'm going to be doing my...